Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The University of Wyoming head football coach is retiring after 10 seasons. Craig Bohl brought consistency and toughness to the program and delivered some huge wins.
Bedlam and Laramie, big upset here. Wyoming out of the Mountain West takes down the Big 12's Texas Tech.
We'll have more on Craig Bohl's legacy. Wyoming has the most people who take their own life per capita in the country. Getting help for mental health problems is not easy for firearm owners.
If we're trying to reduce firearms deaths across the board, we shouldn't push other people into feeling like they have no other place to go.
Driving an electric vehicle requires battery chargers, kind of like gas stations, and Wyoming is a bit of a desert for the chargers. Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This time on the Modern West, Ariel makes the trip back to see the burn scar that was once her childhood home. It makes her feel strangely homesick.
Imagining one's neighborhood meet its end, engulfed in flames. I wonder if this is all part of the feeling of solastalgia.
Solastalgia. It's part two of our series, The Burn Scar. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
Hi there. This is Megan Feary, the host of the podcast Human Nature from Wyoming Public Media. Real stories where humans and our habitat meet. Our latest season has a little bit of everything. A woman who followed the gray whale migration, a man who worked as a night shepherd in Switzerland, a porcupine raid, animal rescues, and a good old-fashioned grizzly bear encounter. Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. University of Wyoming head football coach Craig Bohl is retiring at the end of this season. He built a legacy of consistency and toughness in 10 years in Laramie, a place where it's not always easy to win. Wyoming Public Radio's Will Walkie reports on the longest tenured coach in program history.
Ride for the brand. Cowboy tough. Those are trademark slogans of Wyoming football. Craig Bohl seemed to understand those words in 2013, immediately after he was hired.
I also understand how important football is in the fabric of this institution, and not only this institution, but around the state. Whether you're in Sheridan, Casper, Thermopolis, this is the state team.
Bohl brought a history of success to Wyoming. He was an assistant at his alma mater, Nebraska, when they were the powerhouse of college football in the 90s. And he won three lower-level national titles as head coach at North Dakota State. But to win in Laramie was a whole new ballgame. The program had just fired the last coach after a mediocre year. Athletic director Tom Berman said in 2013 that the team needed someone with a better track record.
A coach who has developed a culture of toughness, a coach who has recruiting ties in a geographical region where we can be successful.
And at first, it didn't go so well. The Cowboys won just six games in Bohl's first two seasons, but something was brewing. It was in that time period that Bohl recruited a guy from Central California named Josh Allen. He remembers visiting his house on a segment on CBS Sports Radio.
I walked into his home and I said, listen, I've traveled all around the country. You're the one that we want. We're going to build our program on you. And Mom began to break down and cry. And Dad was there. They're a neat family that comes from a farm. And He was a cowboy through and through.
In 2016, Wyoming started Allen at quarterback, and they won five of their first seven games. They then hosted Boise State, who was ranked 13th in the country at the time.
Wyoming has come a long way in a short time to 6-2, and they take down, for the first time since 2002, a ranked team.
The Cowboys made a bowl game for the first time in 5 years that season, and have had just one losing year since. Wyoming has consistently finished in the top half of the Mountain West and delivered some huge upset victories.
The final score! Oh, the score! Wyoming 37, Missouri 31. Bedlam and Laramie, big upset here. Wyoming out of the Mountain West takes down the Big 12's Texas Tech.
The Pokes have also beaten rival Colorado State in the Border War 7 out of the last 8 years. And Bulls developed more players that have made NFL rosters than any other coach in Wyoming history, including Chad Muma, Logan Wilson, and Marcus Epps. In a press conference this week, Bull got emotional.
I sat in countless numbers of living rooms of bright-eyed high school seniors who believed in us and came to our program, who didn't shave, embraced me with tears, saying thank you. I came here as a young man, and I'm leaving as a man.
It wasn't perfect for Bull. He never took home a conference title or earned a national ranking. Fans were sometimes frustrated with his conservative play calling and lack of offensive creativity. But for athletic director Tom Berman, he still earned the respect of the state.
And you could drive from Grable and come to a game in Laramie, and you knew that that group of players and that group of coaches were going to be prepared, they were going to play hard, they were going to leave everything on the field.
Berman promoted current defensive coordinator Jay Sauvel to lead the program. He has zero head coaching experience at the highest level of college football. But he's old school, wears his heart on his sleeve, and loves playing tough.
Our biggest goal is we want to play harder, faster, smarter, and do it longer than our opponent. That's what it comes down to.
Sauvel has a hard ask ahead of him, which is staying relevant as college football changes fast. Players can get paid now and transfer more easily to schools with bigger paychecks and opportunities. The Mountain West Conference also might be adding some tougher teams in Washington State and Oregon State. But Sauvel believes in the infrastructure in Laramie. The team set an attendance record this season and built brand new athletic facilities a few years ago. War Memorial Stadium is getting renovated right now. So the team might have everything it needs to win the conference, which hasn't happened in 30 years.
It was like a 4x4 relay, right? He ran the first 3 laps of it. And he's handing me a baton with a couple hundred meters to go. Everything's in place for us to take steps and have great success and continue to build on what's here.
Bull says he's ready to let someone younger step in, and he can enjoy his horses and golf. For now, he has one more rodeo in him. He'll coach the Pokes in the Arizona Bowl on December 30th. If he takes home a victory, he'll finish his Wyoming career with a winning record. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Waukee.
Now, moving to more sobering news. More than half of the firearm deaths in U.S. are done by suicide, and Wyoming has the highest amount of people who take their own life per capita in the country. But getting help for mental health problems is not easy for firearm owners. That's something Ashley Lubinsky found out when she came out publicly with her own struggles, and she's trying to change that.
And has, you know, helped a friend.
Ashley Lubinsky is sitting cross-leg on a wooden stage in a community center in Laramie. Long black hair covers her plaid blazer.
So my next question is for Deb, and then I promise I'll open it up. But I'm fascinated, so sorry you guys are getting my selfishness. I'm like, tell me more.
She's leading a town hall between two firearm owners who have been open about their own mental health struggles. Lubinsky is having them share what they've done with their handguns when hard times hit.
How to talk to somebody that wants to do it but is worried about the legal liability for it. Like, what would you say to them?
First, I would say don't ignore it. Don't come.
This town hall is part of the first firearms and mental health conference held by the University of Wyoming's Firearms Research Center. Lubinsky is the executive director of the center, and this conference is part of her mission to get rid of the stigma gun owners feel about getting help.
If they're honest with their therapist or their psychiatrist that they are having suicidal ideation, and maybe even not that extreme, but they're just struggling with something, can that be misinterpreted in some respects as, you know, needing to have all their firearms taken away from them?
Lubinsky is a firearms historian, She's spent her career trying to tell the social history of guns, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But as her career skyrocketed, she started noticing that something was not right with herself.
I noticed that there was just kind of this dichotomy to my personality. And it didn't always happen that way, but I did notice that as I kind of got busier and busier, that's when I would notice periodically I would kind of crash.
She started seeing a therapist, and it took a while, but she was eventually diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder. She says that helped her handle it, but she started becoming acutely aware of society's perspective of gun owners with mental health problems. An advertisement for a gun organization made her want to take action.
And they were like, you know, you don't want a crazy person to get a gun. And then me having, you know, mental illness and trying to kind of reconcile with that and what that meant and how people can get help when that's the attitude so many people share.
So she decided to be honest with the world about her diagnosis. And she says she was shocked by the amount of private messages she got from people who felt afraid to get help, mainly because they think their firearms will be taken away.
First and foremost, what people need to understand is, as a clinician, I have no legal right to take anyone's firearms.
That's Cheryl D. Woody Fulland. She's a licensed clinical social worker based in Rollins. She says in Wyoming, clinicians can't take away guns, but that isn't necessarily true in other states. Many of her clients are ranchers and agricultural producers.
I've dealt with clients who have had suicidal ideation, who have firearms, usually on them because it's part of their work. Those are tools of their trade.
Fulland says she tries to explain to ranchers that getting help doesn't mean taking away a firearm, but rather working with someone to get them into a better place.
9 times out of 10, that person will calm down enough that we can have the conversation, because that's their fear. Their fear of being locked up, the fear of losing whatever they have, the fear of not being able to get their firearms back.
Those discussions really come down to education, which is what Walk the Talk America is trying to do nationally. Michael Sedini is the founder.
People always assume that, you know, guns and mental health are mutually exclusive, and if you mix the two, then you can get in trouble.
So his company is working on trying to get people to fight that stigma. He says gun manufacturers have long avoided it, but they're starting to get on board. Some are adding free and anonymous mental health screenings in the boxes of their guns.
Bought a gun, you should have a suicide prevention plan and a better mental health plan. You shouldn't be denied that. That should be something that you talk about in your gun ownership. That should start all the way from the get-go.
Education is what Lubinsky, the firearms historian, is trying to do. But she says the issue of firearms has just become too political and heated recently.
I don't think either community necessarily realizes that in their passion to defend what they believe in, that they are maybe pushing people to a point to not get help, or pushing people to a point where they don't feel like they can get help.
Lubinsky says as she tries to talk to both sides, she starts to feel bullied from both directions, and sometimes that's putting a strain on her mental health.
If we're trying to reduce firearms deaths across the board, we shouldn't push other people into feeling like they have no other place to go.
If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, dial 988. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Kamila Kadalska. Up next, the Northern Arapaho Tribe will have a case in the United States Supreme Court. This is Open Spaces.
Every day, Wyoming Public Radio brings you the news, from the latest on the war in Ukraine to ongoing issues of climate change, energy, and the economy. Tune in for what's happening here in Wyoming, around the Mountain West, and beyond, with state and regional news updates during Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered. And you can find the latest news anytime at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Stay informed with Wyoming Public Radio.
Do Do you have a favorite classical music composer? On Classical Wyoming, you can hear the compositions of Grieg, Tchaikovsky, Liszt, and many more played by full orchestras or on solo instruments. And Classical Wyoming is available 24 hours every day. For more information, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Northern Arapaho Tribe is taking a case against the Department of Health and Human Services to the highest court in the United States, the Supreme Court. The lawsuit in question revolves around funding for healthcare and questions of tribal self-governance, and its outcome could have a big impact on the financial future of the tribe. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman spoke about the case with Adam Krippel, a law professor at Loyola University.
To start us off, Adam, what is your background in Indigenous law and policy, and how did you get interested in this field?
I'm enrolled in the United Homa Nation, located in Louisiana. And right when I started law school, the BP oil spill happened. And the Homa are located directly on Louisiana's Gulf Coast, so we were hit hard by the spill. And it seemed like everyone in Louisiana was receiving BP money except the United Homa Nation. As a first-year law student, I assumed all my professors would know about Indian law and everything else. I quickly learned that was not the case. And same thing with seemingly every lawyer in Louisiana. So I just took it upon myself to learn about Indian law. And the more I learned, the more intrigued I got. And that's how I became a professor.
Before we dive into the specifics of this current case, could you just take a minute to explain the relationship between the Federal Indian Health Service, which is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, and tribes in the U.S.? How does that sort of partnership help provide care to tribal communities on the ground?
Yeah, so the federal government has been providing health care to tribes for about 200 years now. So going back to the Jefferson administration, in fact, it's offered health services to tribes. And eventually that got codified into treaties, and it's evolved over the years, and its current manifestation, as you said, is the Indian Health Services. So today, the IHS offers numerous programs for tribes that will operate healthcare and various healthcare centers on reservations. And for our purposes, one of the things to keep in mind is that on the IHS, the fundings can be transferred directly to tribes themselves, pursuant to 1970 self-determination legislation for tribes. And what studies have consistently shown is that when tribes take over the healthcare programs, they tend to outperform the federal government. And the IHS itself does not have the best record when it comes to healthcare.
Thanks for explaining a little bit of that history and just the way in which that partnership is written into treaty. I think that's important for people to remember. So with that context in mind, what's going on in this case specifically involving the Northern Arapaho Tribe and the Department of Health and Human Services?
Yeah, so the Northern Arapaho Tribe has a contract to perform the health services on its reservation. So pursuant to the federal legislation I just referenced, it has a contract with the IHS. And the contract specifically contemplates the tribe is going to bill third-party insurers like private insurance companies, Medicare, and Medicaid. And so what happens is with the federal self-determination legislation is the federal government transfers the funding the IHS would use to serve the tribe to the tribe itself. But what they found out when they first implemented this policy, Congress, is that the tribes have costs, the IHS does not on the administrative side. So the direct cost, there's no issues there. What sets issue in this case is known as contract support cost. So how much overhead is the tribe or the federal government willing to provide for the tribe, such as auditing and things like that? So in this case, the tribe is saying the Indian Health Services owes funds to cover on the third party insurance too, contract support costs for private insurance companies, Medicare and Medicaid. And the federal government, whenever it was sent the bill, said, nope, we're not paying that. So the tribe sued, and that's what brings us to federal court.
Just to make sure I'm following along. So basically, there's two options where either the IHS can sort of provide the healthcare services, or the tribes can take that funding and provide those services themselves. And sometimes that involves contracting with third-party companies, like you said. And there's some fees associated with, you know, doing that third-party contracting. And essentially, those are the fees that they're asking the government to cover.
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Let's talk outcomes. Can you walk us through what the different rulings might look like for this case, and how might those rulings impact members of the Northern Arapaho Tribe and just impact tribal self-governance more broadly?
Yeah, so as you might imagine, like most legal cases, this one's all about money. And that's one of the problems with how the IHS historically is just grossly underfunded. What's going to happen with the tribes, if they prevail, then they'll have funding to take over the more programs. But if the tribes lose at the Supreme Court, then they won't be able to collect out of the contract support costs from third parties. And if you can't collect the contract support costs, the tribes will have to bear those costs themselves. And it's going to be much more expensive to manage these programs, and tribes might reconsider even accepting private insurance and other insurers like that. But what the feds are saying is if Northern Arapaho prevails, then this is going to deplete funding from the tribes that do not have self-governance contracts. That's kind of how the federal government's pitching it as a catch-22. Sure, Northern Arapaho will be better off, but it's going to harm all the other tribes that don't have self-governance contracts.
From your perspective, how many tribes have sort of the same setup that the Northern Arapaho tribe has with the self-governance, and how many have the alternative route of just using that funding from the IHS directly?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number offhand, but a significant portion of tribes do have self-governance contracts.
Gotcha. In the two outcomes you described, where tribes do receive essentially more of this funding from the IHS, and the Northern Arapaho tribe specifically receives more of this funding, or the alternative where they're having to cover these costs themselves, what are the implications for the tribe directly? How might that impact their financial plans, their business plans? How might that impact just people on the ground?
And that is the issue. Yeah. So if the tribe's not getting those costs reimbursed, then the tribe's going to have to find the funding to cover those costs some other way. So it's going to have to take funding from, you know, already cash-strapped budgets in many cases. So you might have less cops on the road, or, you know, you might not have the road paved that might have otherwise been paved. So tribes are going to have to make hard budgeting decisions.
Adam, anything else that you want to add in terms of this case that would help just the average person in Wyoming or on the Wind River Reservation better understand this case and how it might impact them specifically?
Well, I guess about the case itself, the opinion, I probably should have discussed that a little bit. So at the 10th Circuit, there was three judges who heard the case, and all three of the judges agreed. It's a very complicated, the statutory scheme. One judge, however, said the statutory was complicated, but clearly in favor of the tribes. Another judge says the statute was complicated, but clearly in favor of the feds. The third judge, who had the deciding vote, said it's complicated and ambiguous. Therefore, we're going to go to the Indian Canons of Construction. Now, those go back to the 1830s, and they basically say if a statute's ambiguous and it can be reasonably construed in favor of the tribes, the courts are supposed to do that. So basically, a tie goes to the tribe, essentially. It was a close call, and the tribes barely prevailed at the 10th Circuit. So we'll see what happens at the Supreme Court. And I guess on that note, the Supreme Court has not been very favorable to tribal interest in recent years. So we'll see.
I've been talking with Adam Krepel, who's an assistant professor at the Loyola University School of Law. Adam, thanks so much for walking us through this case and what it might mean for people on the ground. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
A date isn't set for the Supreme Court to hear arguments for the case, but it will likely take place in 2024. For 150 years, Native Americans were sent off to boarding schools supported by the U.S. government. They were stripped of their language and other cultural ties, and forced to assimilate into an American lifestyle. Arizona journalist Sierra Alvarez spoke with her 84-year-old grandmother about the experience in this special report for the Mountain West News Bureau.
My name is Sierra Alvarez. I am a descendant of an Indian boarding school survivor. My grandmother, Anita Yellowhair, went to the Intermountain Indian School in northern Utah, over 500 miles away from her home in Steamboat, Arizona.
My Native American Navajo name is Yellowhair, Anita Yellowhair.
My grandmother never spoke much about her boarding school experience, until now. I believe this was because she never wanted to dwell on the past or reopen old wounds. I also believe she didn't want to open new wounds for her children, and for me, her granddaughter. When she finally told me about what happened to her, I was angry. But mostly, it made me in a way depressed to hear the full story. She had to stop speaking Navajo and learn English, and she couldn't wear her traditional clothes or hairstyle.
That's the most embarrassing moment of my life, getting my hair cut. Because every one of us, It's a spiritual thing. We all believe in the spirit and creator. We carry a little medicine bag, depend on that medicine bag to protect us.
When she did speak in her native language, she was punished.
You have to wash the toilet all night or sit down the hall with your hand against the wall with your knees on the floor. That's a torture.
I was never taught how to speak Navajo because my family wanted me to learn English and live my life the white man's way. I never realized the importance of embracing my culture because, as a family, we had lost our way for so long that sometimes it feels as if it's too late. More than a year ago, she first started telling me her story. Little by little, I learned of her painful experience, including corporal punishment and sexual abuse.
We lived there and inside, we were closed up, like prisoners. Yeah, of course, abusers did not understand English and they're talking to you, and you don't speak up. That's a rule that you have to learn how, but they don't explain why.
Can you tell me how you were abused?
Well, hit with your bare hand. You're not allowed to cry.
And there was more, much more. My grandmother recalls being told to go into town with a white boy who had a truck. She was given 50 cents to buy some socks.
So this boy takes me down to the store. He abused me there in the car. And that's the way they took advantage of us, is taking us somewhere and hiding and do what they wish to us.
When you say he abused you, did you mean sexual abuse?
I'm just feeling across your breast and trying to put their hand in your panty and you're trying to cover up, and it's not enough. They're all white men.
How old were you?
I was about 17, 16.
And no one believed you when you would tell?
No, they didn't believe us, and they interviewed the... Well, I was embarrassed to answer before him. But there were a lot of boys like that, and all they did was take them from school, and that was it.
To hear my grandmother's story for a second time was challenging. I had no idea she was sexually assaulted at her school. That hit me hard because I know how dehumanizing sexual assault can be to a woman. She shares how she feels about it now.
I don't feel anything. I think it goes on every day and night. I think it's something that's going on all the time. And our parents didn't believe us either. But they want the people to be nice to us, and so that's why they agree with them.
Did you resent your parents for that?
No, because I didn't know what was going on.
Despite that abuse, my grandmother became a dental assistant after graduating from the Intermountain Indian School in 1960. She ended up working for Dr. Bill Thomas, the only dental officer for the U.S. Public Health Service Indian Hospital at the time, for more than a year in Winslow. Later on, Yellowhair moved to Chicago, where she gave birth to her daughter, Noelle Alvarez, my mother. Why do you want to talk about your boarding experience now, as opposed to when you were younger?
Nobody cared about it until a couple of times, a few years ago, it happened to. I just thank you very much for being interested. I want to know why I'm interested now.
Despite the beatings, despite the sexual abuse, despite every other wound my grandmother has endured, she is so forgiving to every single person who has harmed her in any way. I'm happy she found God to cope with what happened to her. Because while it wasn't fair, it's the truth. And I will always be interested in my grandmother's story. She is a piece of history that has been swept under the rug time and time again. She tells me that she still works to heal to this day.
And for you, Sierra, I advise you, find your happiness, find your path, right away, or else you're just going to wander in the desert like I have been. I'm at the end of my trail.
That was Arizona journalist Sierra Alvarez speaking with her grandmother, Anita Yellowhair. The Intermountain Indian School closed its doors in 1984. Utah State University built a campus over the remains of the school. Up next on Open Spaces, Wyoming has fewer and fewer places where a baby can be delivered.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kodalska. Wyoming has a growing maternity care shortage. WyoFile's Katie Klingsporn has taken the time to dig into the causes and impacts of the lack of resources for expecting mothers in this state. Her investigative work is being released throughout December every Wednesday. Two stories are out already. The first article told the stories of many families upending their lives to find care. I asked her to share one of their stories.
First, I will say they were all sort of harrowing. And I think it just goes to show that, you know, having a baby is a really big deal, even in cases when it goes, quote unquote, smooth. Maybe an exemplary story would be the woman, Bailey. She had a lot of complications in her first pregnancy, in her first labor, and she ended up getting life-flighted, and her daughter was born via C-section 5 weeks early. And so when she got pregnant again and she started looking around for options, knowing that she was high risk, she didn't feel comfortable with what Fremont County had to offer her. So she decided to go to Salt Lake City and have her baby, and she ended up having a VBAC, which is a vaginal birth after cesarean, and you can't do it in most Wyoming hospitals. They just don't allow it because of the risk for rupture. It kind of was really telling of a lot of our shortages.
Regarding those shortages, you kind of focus on Fremont County. So if you can talk about how, you know, maybe even 5 years ago, there didn't seem to be a problem, and how that has changed.
Fremont County is not unique in this. It's kind of this bad coincidence, these factors converging all at once. And one doctor told me, you know, she believes a big part of it is that there are a lot of OBGYNs who are sort of in the same age group, and they're all hitting retirement age. So a lot of people are leaving, but 2020, there was a independent practice at the clinic. There were two OBs and two midwives, and then there was a private practice with an OB. And the hospital here, the OB has to be on call at all times, even if the midwife is delivering the baby, in case the need for a cesarean section or surgery comes up. So that's why the OBs are such a crucial part of the puzzle. They always need to be available. You know, things just happen. One of the OBs had a medical issue and he ended up leaving. And one of the midwives decided to pursue something else. And all of a sudden it was down to two, OB and a nurse midwife. And that OB, who's in my second story, he just got really burnt out. He's been doing it for a long time. The call schedule is very onerous when you're sharing it with one other person. I think it was an agonizing decision, but he walked away. So now we're down to, there is one OB here. He has a midwife also. If a woman goes into labor, she will be able to deliver her baby at Sagewest Hospital in Lander. But there is a greater chance that she will deliver with locums, which is a traveling doctor. And for pregnant women, like the idea of delivering with a doctor who you've never met or never seen before can cause a lot of anxiety, and it's just not something they want to do.
It's like a revolving door, you know, someone retires, that puts a burden on someone else, and then they feel like they can't do it anymore. And it's putting a burden on the rest of the facilities in the state that exist. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how there only being one OB in Fremont County, how that's putting more pressure to other communities in the state.
Yeah, a lot of Fremont County women are choosing to go to Hot Springs Health in Thermopolis. Their demand is growing because of that. But, you know, when I talked to the Lander doctor, he said it used to be that people would come here from elsewhere, and now it feels like it's reversed. So there are also quite a few patients who go to Jackson, and Jackson is having its own version of the crunch. Unfortunately, several providers there have recently stepped away as well. I think one OBGYN told me that five providers in recent years have either closed or moved out.
And I know that you still have a couple of more parts of this series that come out and that they might look at some solutions. Could you talk a little bit about that?
It's a really tricky situation, and everybody agrees that it is hard and it's not good. And, you know, there's community leaders who say, like, we have to have a hospital and a birthing facility in order to build a strong community, you know, for our economic future. Out of the ideas that people have thrown around, one concrete solution is what has been happening in Riverton. You know, some residents got together, created a medical district, and they are building a community-owned hospital in Riverton. And part of that is in response to the services that were closed at the Riverton Sagewest campus. One of those services is OB. Another solution I think can be found on the reservation at Wind River Cares and IHS, where they're just concentrating a lot of energy and resources into building out their OB team, and as well as other support services. For example, they have a really robust transportation assistance for their patients if they need to, you know, have or be referred to specialists elsewhere. And they have nurses who are basically assigned a family. So when the women become pregnant, they feel like they have like a team tracking them and looking out for them.
Thank you so much, Katie, for speaking with me.
Yeah, thanks, Camilla.
I was speaking with Wildfile journalist Katie Klingsporn, who's the author of the investigative series Delivery Desert. Two stories are out now on wildfile.com, and keep an eye out for the new stories every Wednesday this month. Now to another type of desert in the state. More electric vehicles are on the road in the U.S. than ever before. And in big urban areas, driving an EV isn't much different than driving a gas vehicle. EV chargers are found almost everywhere. But in more rural areas, it gets complicated. Wyoming is the ninth largest state land-wise, but it only has 95 charging stations. For comparison, neighboring Colorado has over 2,000 stations. So traveling Wyoming in an EV is near impossible in some areas. Private companies see this as an opportunity to build out the infrastructure, but the state is hesitant. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports.
Big one-ton diesel trucks are something you see a lot of in Wyoming, a state known for large swaths of untouched, rugged land.
You've got 100 miles between everything. There's very little civilization.
David Halter is a fourth-generation Wyomingite from Rock Springs that grew up with the culture of big trucks. But 4 years ago, he and his wife went electric.
No particular reason other than electricity is cheaper.
They recently went on a road trip to see the sights of Wyoming, including Yellowstone. But it was tricky. They had to drive into Montana to charge their car, spending their money there instead of their favorite Wyoming towns.
I like to go to those places, but I can't now because there's very little charging in those locations.
Tourism is a $4.5 billion industry in Wyoming, partly because of its huge road trip destinations like Grand Teton National Park and Devil's Tower. And with more people driving EVs, the Great American Road Trip now requires charging stations, something Wyoming doesn't have a lot of, at least not yet.
I just wanted to welcome you guys. I like to say that it's infrastructure week when we open one of these chargers.
Mike Yin speaks to a small crowd at a ribbon cutting for his EV charging company's new station in Pinedale.
This creates a route between I-80 and Yellowstone.
Now you can find the steady hum of an EV charging station right behind the downtown coffee shop. Some locals came out to see the new charger. Yin, who's also a member in Wyoming's legislature, shows how to use it on his Tesla.
Now you make sure your car is plugged in, take it out of the port, put it in the adapter. It's essentially like a gas pump, right? Instead of pumping liquid gas, it's pumping electrons to the batteries.
Prior to this, there was one charger in town. It's only for Teslas and takes about 8 hours to charge. It's mostly forgotten and often blocked by diesel trucks. But this new one can charge all kinds of EVs in about 30 minutes. Pinedale's Mayor Matt Murdock hopes this'll bring in tourism dollars. The next closest chargers are 77 miles one direction and 135 miles another.
It opens up Pinedale to a wide variety of tourists who would normally, you know, not come up this direction because otherwise their batteries die and they can't make the distance.
Pinedale has long been known for its natural gas fields and ranching, but Murdock says they can all coexist.
We produce a ton of energy here. This is just another source. And so, you know, I don't think we want to say we don't want anybody who doesn't drive electric vehicles in Sublette County, right?
This is just one of four locations that Yin opened in Wyoming this year at about $150,000 a pop, all on his company's dime.
One of the reasons I built something without any government funds at all was to say, yes, that it is possible for stations in Wyoming to work.
That's because the state isn't so sure. This spring, Wyoming put a pause on federal funding for EV charging stations. It was about $26 million the state could have doled out over 5 years to private businesses. But Jordan Young with the state's Department of Transportation says there are a few concerns. Like, what if a business went under before that 5 years? Like, how would the state not bear that responsibility?
So we wanted to make sure that there was mechanisms in place in case the stations did not stay open that full 5 years.
They're working that out with the feds now. And another thing they're negotiating is how far apart the chargers can be. Right now, the funding requires every 50 miles.
We don't even have towns every 50 miles. We don't necessarily even have gas station every 50 miles. It's a lot of pronghorn and sagebrush.
If an agreement can be reached, that money is still available as soon as next year for private businesses like Yin's, who says they'll build out more chargers if that money is available. So that leaves much of that sagebrush landscape accessible to diesel trucks and pronghorn, not electric vehicles. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Pinedale.
And to finish the show off, we visit with two historians who tell the little-known history of Wyoming Mexican beet farmers. This is Open Spaces.
My very first car was a VW GTI.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad of Radiolab.
I always really lusted after this GTI because it was so perfect and sporty. I just loved the shape of it, and the thing gave me nothing but grief. I broke down on the Brooklyn Bridge. I pushed this thing across many lanes of traffic. It was just a freaking piece of junk. It's cool to think that even that car can be turned into an episode of Radiolab. Turn your car into the programs that you love.
For more information about vehicle donation, visit wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadelska. Have you ever heard of the Beta Belarus? Neither had University of Wyoming professors Conchita Domonique and Chelsea Escalante. That was until they came across a 1920s newspaper called La Página Española. Published entirely in Spanish, this special page in the Powell Tribune was made for communities of Mexican-American beet farmers. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger spoke with them about their findings.
So it was brought to our attention that this newspaper existed. I didn't know anything about the sugar beet workers at that time, had no idea of this community existing in Wyoming 100 years ago. And remember that in the 1800s, this was part of Mexico, the territory in the west was part of Mexico, and then basically the border crossed them. And so at that time, there were many families who had been in that land for many generations. They were Mexican, and then they became United States citizens. But yes, the Betabeleros came both from Mexico itself, New Mexico, Texas, California, and other states. And the sugar companies wanted workers. They needed workers. And so they kind of built these kind of temporary housing communities that they called colonies. And offered this opportunity for low rent housing, and the rent could be taken off the salary that they would so you don't have to have the upfront money. They wanted families instead of just, for example, male adult workers. They wanted it to be a family experience because they thought that there would be a higher chance of the workers staying if the whole family came, and it wouldn't just be for that season. They really wanted year-round workers, and so they wanted to give them the opportunities to have housing and education so that the whole family could come.
Yeah, they recruited them. I mean, the children could go to school, but still, and they did several activities like baseball games and dances. You can see the pictures of the dances in there. But at the same time, for instance, the swimming pool, right? It was, they couldn't go to the swimming pool.
The movie theater.
The movie theater, there was segregation there. And later on, it was segregation in the schools as well. They couldn't. So, yeah, they organized dances, but at the same time, they couldn't do the things that the people who live here, the Anglos, basically, were doing. We are actually at the beginning, and we are still learning about this. We don't have all the answers, but we are very excited about this project.
I actually had a question about that particular part of the investigation here, because it does seem like this is a group of people who obviously had an impact in Wyoming, but do we know a lot about them? Are their practices, their culture, their stories still there to be found, or are some of these insights maybe lost to time and lost to history?
That's one of our main priorities, is to highlight this community because it is often forgotten. The Betabeleros came in great numbers in the 1910s and 20s, but by the 30s, when the Depression hit, a lot of them found themselves going elsewhere, whether it be because a combination of the wages being lower and the expense of living being higher, but then also they started facing a lot more discriminatory practices by the 30s. As the numbers grew, the local schools, the population, the white population didn't want their kids going to school with the Mexican kids. And so the schools became segregated at different points. And so I think there was a pressure for some of them to move away, that they weren't wanted here. And as such, kind of a forgotten part of Wyoming history. There were some that stayed, and there are many descendants of the Batabeleros that still live in Wyoming. But we want to really highlight the fact that this was an important part of Wyoming's history, and that they weren't always, you know, welcomed in the state, and kind of working to shine light on all of their contributions so that they are honored as part of history.
From your research, it's clear that there was animosity towards them, that some people did not want them to be there. The one picture that I saw in the exhibit over there, they were holding an American flag and a Mexican flag. I think this might have still been in the time period where people didn't smile in photos, but they were clearly excited to be here and have a combination of these cultures. Is that the impression that you also got from your studies?
Actually, yesterday I was reading the last page of La Página en Español, and the part they say, well, there is not any reason to continue these pages because you are living, because the Batabeleros are living, because it's winter is coming and they will not have work. And actually they were very, very sad because it seems like they didn't want them to leave, and they were promoting to stay in Wyoming. But at the same time, there are all these ads from business saying, oh, so sad that you are leaving, please come back. And there is a column that is very funny because it's like, please don't leave. But remember, if you leave, you have to pay the 1 peso that it costs to get the page, right? And it was very funny, the 1 peso.
Are you hoping to spark a larger conversation just within the historical community or at large? Or with this project, are you looking more to add to public knowledge to make sure that certain things don't go unrecorded?
Yeah, I think both. I think our first step is just sharing this information with the community, having more people become aware of the Batabeleros and their history in Wyoming. And then we also want to publish a book eventually about this. And ideally, we would love to publish in Spanish, because from what we found, there have been some publications, but everything that I've seen about the Batabeleros is in English. And so I think sharing this story in the native language of the community is great. We can share it with, you know, U.S. Spanish speakers and Spanish speakers around the world about how this community has existed and how they're part of our history.
And the exhibit itself is bilingual. We have the page in Spanish, and underneath we have the translation that we did some, and the students as well. So we try to show Wyoming that Wyoming is not only Anglo-Saxon, and Wyoming is not only English, that we have, that Spanish is also the language of Wyoming.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger speaking with two University of Wyoming professors on the unknown history of Mexican-American beet farmers. And thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The show can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Caitlin Tan, our producer, and Eric Vigil, our digital producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.